So we're going to go back to that cartoon over here. I think it's one of the most essential, basic aspects of black holes that I think that needs to be understood, and having to do with the distinction between event horizon and apparent horizon. Apparent horizon just being the name that we give to the boundary of the trapped region. So I drew this earlier today. I think I had this part of it slightly wrong in my earlier attempt, but this is what it looks like. So the point is that, if you look at this thick boundary over here, to the left of this, we have trapped regions, we have trapped surfaces. On the right of it, we don't. And there's a clear distinction between this boundary over here and the causal boundary of the black hole that corresponds to a null hypersurface that at late times asymptotes to r equals 2m, where m is understood to be the final mass of the black hole after all the stuff that's fallen in is accounted for. So the idea is that to figure out where this boundary is, the boundary of trapped regions, the way to figure this out is to calculate the expansion of outgoing light rays. And when that's zero, that's where you go from untrapped to trapped. So that's where the boundary is. But to locate the event horizon, it's really an exercise in solving a partial differential equation for the null surface with boundary conditions that are placed at late times. So it's not an initial value problem, it's a final value problem. And the surfaces are completely distinct. And I think that's something that's important about black holes, but something that's revealed only when there's a time dependence. So if all we do is to play around with static black holes or stationary black holes, none of that distinction can be sort of brought out. But if we do bring in a time dependence, then this is what happens. So now the idea is that if we wanted to flesh this out and give that some quantitative detail, we would have to come up with a time-dependent space-time that describes an evolving black hole. And that can be very complicated to do if we really care about describing the enfalling matter in any form of realistic, manner. So that can be very complicated, but here I'm going to introduce a very simple space-time that does that at the cost of not describing the enfalling matter with any, sense of realism. But doesn't matter. I mean, we can still bring out all of those aspects to the description of black holes with a very simple model. And I think that makes it a very successful model, especially in view of its simplicity. So what I'm about to introduce here is called the Vedia spacetime. Sorry. And it's a spherically symmetric spacetime that describes a black hole. But it's going to be a time-dependent black hole, and it's going to be an evolving black hole. So let's write down the metric. So it's going to have exactly the same form as the Schwarzschild metric that we wrote down before in the VR theta phi coordinate system. So it will look like this. So we still write it out in terms of VR theta and phi coordinates. We rely on the fact that V is going to be a nice coordinate to take us across the horizon. F will be exactly or almost exactly the same as what we had before, 1 minus 2m over r. But the only change that we're going to make is that now we declare that the mass is going to be time dependent in the sense that it will depend on V, our time coordinate. And I say that's a nice space-time to play with, and that will represent a black hole for which the mass is actually changing with time. So it should help us reveal those features of the black hole space-time. So you can always do that. Write down a metric and declare that this is the metric of some space-time that you happen to be interested in. So typically what happens, though, is that if you also demand that this metric be a solution to the Einstein field equations, then you run into trouble. So this metric is not going to be a solution to the vacuum equation. That would be true, of course, if m is constant. But here, by declaring that the mass is going to be time dependent, we're saying, well, we give up on that. And of course, we want to give up on that because we want the metric to have infalling matter in it. We want the space-time to have that infalling matter. So you can always do that. You can always write down a metric and say that this is a nice metric. And you can always declare that this is a solution to the field equations by saying, well, here's the metric. Let's calculate the Einstein tensor. Let's apply the field equations. The Einstein tensor gives us the stress energy tensor for the matter, and that's the matter that produces that space-time. You can always do that. So nothing is easier than to find a solution to the Einstein field equations. You write down any metric you want, and the T mu nu that you get for that metric is the T mu nu of the matter that produces that space-time. So what's the big fuss about finding solutions to the Einstein field equations? Well, the problem is that the T mu nu that you'll get for that metric that you happen to like is going to have all sorts of palatable properties. For example, the energy conditions might be violated. You'll never be able to find a matter source that would actually give you that stress tensor. You know, if you say that it should be a perfect fluid or scalar field or an electromagnetic field, whatever you write down is not going to be compatible with any of those physical requirements. So bottom line is that that exercise gives you a T mu nu that's completely meaningless. So we should expect the same here. We wrote down a metric because we liked it, and I'm going to work out the Einstein tensor from that, and I'm going to associate it with a stress tensor. But in this case, the stress tensor actually has a very nice compelling form, and we're going to declare ourselves very lucky to have landed on such a simple solution to the Einstein field equations. So if we work out the Einstein tensor for this metric, we're going to find that the only non-vanishing component of the Einstein tensor is GVV. And that happens to be equal to 2 times m dot, the time derivative of m, divided by r squared. And what this means, of course, is that, according to the field equations, we're going to have one non-vanishing component to the stress tensor. And after accounting for the 8 pi and everything, g mu nu is 8 pi times t mu nu. So it's going to be m dot over 4 pi r squared. So that's the t mu nu that we get. And in principle, we're not allowed to ask for any sort of physical interpretation for that t mu nu. But we can make one up. I can write down the T mu nu in a nice form that will suggest that this is something like a pressureless fluid. I'm going to say that my stress tensor, the full stress tensor, is going to be aligned with a vector that points entirely in the V direction, and the V direction happens to be a null direction. So this is a stress tensor that has, an alignment with a null vector. So I'm just going to write it as m dot over 4 pi r squared. And I'm going to say that this is multiplying L alpha L beta. And L alpha L beta, L alpha is just going to be defined to be minus the gradient of V, so that L alpha turns out to be normal to, normal to null surfaces, the surfaces V equal constant. And those happen to be the incoming light cones. And L, the vector, is tangent to those ingoing null geodesics. So that's the interpretation we're going to give to the stress tensor. This is a null vector tangent to ingoing light rays. And what we have is a stress tensor that looks a lot like what we would get for a perfect fluid. The stress energy tensor of a perfect fluid would be the energy density multiplying the velocity of the fluid. And then we would have a pressure term that involves the orthogonal directions to that. And if we say, okay, well, we're dealing with a fluid like this, except that it has no pressure, we're going to kill the pressure. And we're going to say that that fluid, in fact, has a velocity vector that's not time-like, but null. So we're basically describing a pressureless null fluid, sometimes called null dust. And I think we have a stress tensor that has a perfectly compelling interpretation in terms of, you know, a fluid that you would associate with, you know, particles falling in with the speed of light. So it's a very nice space-time. It's a very amazingly, you know, it's an amazing space-time given its simplicity and how compelling that, you know, that just slight modification to the Schwarzschild solution is. If you try to do this in terms of the original coordinates, in terms of the t variable, the stress tensor you would get from that would be completely uninterpretable. It would give you a mess. But because we were wise to do this with v instead of t, we have a perfectly nice, compelling interpretation to the stress tensor. So a very nice space-time that I happen to like a lot. Okay, so we have a stress tensor, and we would like to impose the energy conditions on this. And the energy conditions will tell us that the density that appears here should be something positive. And that tells us that the mass function has to be an increasing function of v. So the black hole is, you know, acquiring mass, and you know, that mass has to be positive. So the energy conditions will imply, you know, if we care about those, will imply that m dot has to be positive, which means that m has to be increasing with v. And the interpretation of this, I think, is clear. It means that the black hole is getting new mass, you know, just as in the situation displayed there in the cartoon. So very nice space-time to play with. And we can do calculations in that space-time, and we can, you know, set it all up so that we can, you know, really examine in a quantitative way where the boundary of trap region, the trap region is, where the event horizon is, and so on. So let's basically do something that's exactly like the cartoon, but now fully fleshed out in terms of that Vedia model. So I'm going to display a diagram here. It's going to be basically a rectified version of that cartoon, but now it's based on that description. I'm going to come up with a description where R goes sideways like this. We're going to be plotting R in that direction, and I'm going to be plotting V in that direction. And the reason why I'm skewing my axis here is simply to say that, well, the spatial direction is going to be sideways as usual. And V is going to be it's a null direction. So I'm going to display it at 45 degrees so that we can sort of see that light rays propagate at 45 degrees, at least the incoming light rays that are described by V equal constant. So we're going to do it like this. So the center of the space-time, R equals zero, is going to be right here. And what I'm going to do is to let null dust create the black hole in the first place. So we're going to have a first inflow of matter that will correspond to some regime of time where the mass increases. And I'm going to represent this on the diagram by some strip like this, where inside of that strip we have momentarily conditions where m dot is increasing. So we're going to start with m equals zero, because we want to form the black hole first, and we're going to form it by an inflow of null dust. So we imagine that we have spherical shells of matter falling in with the speed of light. That's what is being described here. And of course, as soon as we have in falling matter, we have the creation of a singularity at the center. So we get that. So that's the formation event. And then, like in the cartoon, I'm going to have some, you know, later, I'm going to send in more matter in the form of null dust. So I'm going to have a second strip here where, for a duration, I'm going to have another, you know, regime where the mass is increasing. And in between, we're going to have a constant mass. So m is going to be constant. So let's call it m1. And after that, m is going to be another constant, m2. And we can imagine, you know, that this repeats over and over again, but I think it makes the point to have just the creation event and then the infalling matter that comes somewhat later. Okay, so a claim I'm going to make is that, and we're going to back this up in a moment, I'm going to say that in this spacetime, the boundary of the trapped region corresponding to the rate of expansion for outgoing light rays going to zero, that's going to be at R equals 2m of v. So the boundary is right there. And what this means is that, well, we had no trapped surfaces to begin with, and as soon as we switch on the mask, this starts to happen. So we have the boundary that goes from zero to R equals 2m1 in the course of the creation event of the black hole. And then beyond that point, m is constant. So R equals 2m is constant like this. And then after that, we have another increase as m increases, and eventually we settle to that constant R value over here. So this is R equals 2m1. This is R equals 2m2. And in between, we have R equals 2m of V. And the claim, if you believe me for the time being, that this is where the boundary lies, then what we have is that the boundary of trapped surfaces, or the boundary of the trapped region, grows from zero to R equals 2m during the first infall of matter and stays constant, then grows here, and then settles down to here. So it's basically the same drawing, but now, a little bit more precise because we're doing something based on an actual mathematical description. Okay, so that's the first thing. So that's where the boundary of the trap region is. And then where's the event horizon? Well, the event horizon is going to be that null surface that asymptotically becomes R equals 2m2. So if we were to, in principle, we wait an infinite time, we identify the final mass of the spacetime at late times. We take the surface R equals 2m for that final mass, and then we trace it back in the past, and we make sure that the surface stays null at all times. So the boundary of the black hole in this picture is going to be exactly as I drew it before, but now we have a hope of actually describing this mathematically, given the model that we're dealing with. So this is the event horizon. Defined to be a null surface that at late times, at asymptotes to R equals 2m, where we're talking about m at the latest times. So we start, so we locate the surface at late times, and then we trace it backwards in time until, its creation point right here at the center. Okay, so, and that, quantitatively, gives us exactly the same sort of picture, but now we have more room to do some calculations. And, just to make the point, finding the event horizon is a matter of solving the differential equation for the final null rays that will become stationary at late times. And then we start here and trace backwards in time. That's how we locate the event horizon. And in the homework assignment, I'm going to give you, the task of doing this. And it's going to be based on a very, specific model for the mass function. Here, I wouldn't be able to do anything until I specify the mass function. So I wouldn't be able to produce this integration for the null surface until I specify the mass function. But in the homework problem, that's going to be, specified for you. And you'll be able to find the precise location of the event horizon for that specific model. Okay, so that's the beauty of the Vedia spacetime. So we're going to be verifying this in just a moment. And another thing we're going to be verifying is something that I said before, but now we can actually, check this. I'll tell you that this boundary over here, the boundary of the trapped region, that's going to be space-like when m dot is not zero. So those segments over here where the mass is increasing are segments of a space-like surface. And it's going to be null when m dot is equal to zero. So when we don't have an inflow of mass, the segment to the boundary are null surfaces. Okay, so let's start working this out, and I'm not gonna do a lot of details here because the calculations are almost identical to what we did for Schwarzschild. So it's the same idea. We're gonna set up a null vector that's gonna be tangent to outgoing null geodesics. It's gonna be parameterized by V, and then we're gonna calculate everything inside from that. Okay. So now we want to describe the outgoing null geodesics. And it's basically the same exercise that we worked through before in Schwarzschild. The fact that M depends on V doesn't change anything about what we did in terms of factorizing the line element to identify the null directions, dV equals zero being one of them, and then we have what's left over. And I'll just tell you what the answer is. Our K vector here is basically exactly the same as what we had for Schwarzschild, except that now this F is the one that involves the V changing mass. So that's the null vector. We see that, well, that's in coordinates V, R, theta, phi. So the V entry here tells us that the parameter is V. You can verify that this is a null vector. And you can verify that this satisfies the geodesic equation in generalized form with a kappa that has exactly the same form as before. So it's m of v divided by r squared. So it's exactly the same, and except for the fact that the mass depends on v. So all of that is exactly the same, pretty much. And then if we calculate the rate of expansion is going to be as before. That's the general formula for it when we're not using an affine parameterization. So we have calculated kappa. We can calculate the divergence of this vector field in the new metric. Now we do have to worry a little bit about V derivatives because they wouldn't be zero. But anyway, the calculation is pretty much identical to what we had before. And what do we get? We get R minus 2m of V divided by R squared. And sure enough, that's positive when R is larger than 2m of V, negative when it's smaller, and it's zero right at the boundary where R is equal to the changing mass times the factor of 2. So that's the basis for this, and that's the calculation that proves that this is really where the boundary of the trapped region is. All right, so that was something I wanted to establish, and we've got that. And then I want to establish those statements over here about the nature of that boundary. So what I want to prove is that the normal vector to the surface that's going to be time-like when the surface is space-like and null when the surface is null. So we're going to have those two cases right here. So the normal, so now we're looking at the surface R equals 2m in that space-time. And I want to calculate the signature of the normal vector. So the normal vector I'm not going to bother to normalize it here or anything like that. The normal vector is going to be given by, so this is, so my surface, I should say that my surface describing, so the equation describing that surface is going to be the statement that phi is equal to 0. And the normal vector is going to be, well, the sign won't matter here, so I'll just take that to be the straight gradient of the function phi. And if we work this out in the time direction, we're going to have minus 2 m dot. In the radial direction, we're going to get 1. And in the angular directions, we get 0. So that's the normal vector, apart from maybe a sign, maybe apart from a normalization factor. But none of that matters, because what I want to calculate is this here, which will tell me whether the null, the normal vector, whether it's time-like, space-like, or null. So if this happens to be positive, then we know that the normal vector is going to be space-like. If it's negative, then it's time-like. And if it's 0, then it's a null vector. So all we have to do is to calculate this. We have the metric. We can calculate the inverse. So it's a very simple calculation, just algebra. And if you calculate this, what we find is that this is minus 4 m dot, which is either 0 or negative. So it's going to be smaller than 0 if m dot is greater than 0. That is when we have an inflow of matter. And being smaller than 0 means that the normal is time-like. And that means that the surface is space-like. So that's the proof of that claim over there. And then, you know, it can be 0 when m dot is 0. So whenever we don't have a flow of matter, then the normal vector is null, which means that the surface is null. So just a simple calculation like this, by calculating the signature of the normal vector to surface, tells us that those statements are true. And we have that the apparent horizon is basically null segments connected by space-like segments. If we decide that the mass is going to be just continuously increasing, then it's going to be space-like everywhere, except when it stops increasing. So at late times, we have to assume that at some point the mass stops increasing. So eventually, the boundary becomes null. But prior to that, it's either space-like at all times or, you know, space-like or null. So that's the cartoon. That's the, you know, that's the quantitative version of this. It's exactly the same. But now, at least, we have a little space-time we can play with and do all of those things in some detail, and actually do calculations that will tell us, for a given, you know, a given choice of mass function, where the event horizon is if the mass asymptotes to a final, you know, a finite value, a final value at some late time. Right? So Vedic spacetime is very nice like this. It's a very, very simple but very powerful spacetime where we can play those games. There's a version of it where instead of using V, we would use U. And that would describe a spacetime that radiates to infinity. So we can see how the mass at infinity would decrease because the spacetime is radiating out to infinity. So that's, you know, the black hole version of this. But there's also the, you know, infinity version of this, where instead of having an increasing mass, we would have a decreasing mass. So you can play, you know, similar games with that model at infinity instead of on the horizon. And, you know, the beauty of all of this is that the spacetime is really, really simple, but it really illustrates all of those features that would be present in much more complicated models. And, you know, I like simplicity when you can find it. So that's a great example of that. Okay, questions about this? Okay, so far we were dealing with spherical black holes, either static or, you know, evolving in time according to the Vedia solution, but we were imposing spherical symmetry. In the case of Schwarzschild, the spherical symmetry, as I pointed out, comes as a consequence of the uniqueness theorem. So it comes as a consequence of the space-time being static. Now we're going to allow the space-time to be only stationary, not static. And the distinction between the two is that stationary allows for rotation. So now we're going to be talking about rotating black holes. And of course, that means spending some time to get acquainted with the Kerr metric. So, okay, so I'll write down the metric in a moment, but let me just specify some of its features first. So with Schwarzschild, just to recall, we had a static space-time. And what this means mathematically is that we have a time-like killing vector. So that means that we have a killing vector . Well, we had a whole bunch of killing vectors here, but the one that's important for us now is the time-like killing vector. And a property of that time-like killing vector is that it was hypersurface orthogonal. And that means that it is, as the name indicates, it is orthogonal to a family of surfaces, and those are the t equal constant surfaces of the Schwarzschild spacetime. All right. So I didn't insist on that, and I didn't even insist on the killing vector, but it was sort of understood when we were talking about a static spacetime. With Kerr, we have a spacetime that is stationary, not static. And that means that we still have a time-like killing vector, so there is nothing in the metric that will depend on time. But the distinction is that that time-like killing vector is not going to be hypersurface orthogonal. So there is no surfaces in the Kerr metric that would be orthogonal to that vector. So stationary space-time, which means that we still have a killing vector T alpha. In fact, we're going to have another killing vector. I'll talk about it in a second. But this one is not hypersurface orthogonal. And I could have said that the manifestation of this in the Schwarzschild spacetime was that the rotation tensor associated with that vector was zero. And here it means the opposite, that the rotation tensor for that time-like direction is not zero. So that goes back to stuff we were talking about several weeks ago. So what's the distinction really? So that's the mathematical stuff. The distinction is that while this space-time is not rotating, whereas this space-time is rotating. So in the first instance, we were describing a non-rotating black hole, the simplest possible, and that's a static black hole. But if we want our black hole to rotate, then we have a stationary space-time instead of a static space-time, and we have a Kerr black hole instead of a Schwarzschild black hole. So what are the properties? There are lots of stuff to be said about the Kerr black hole, but the first important things is that the Kerr black hole has a mass M, something that, of course, the Schwarzschild black hole had. But it also has an angular momentum J. That the Schwarzschild black hole didn't have. And the rotation, of course, comes with that angular momentum. So it's common for the Kerr metric to write J as another constant times M. The constant is called A. M has dimensions of length in our units. M has dimensions of length. A has dimension of length. And J has dimensions of length squared. So if you work out the units of these quantities in units where G and C are both equal to 1, then you find that this has dimension of length, this has dimensions of length squared, and we express it as a length times another length. An important requirement for a Kerr black hole is that A must always be smaller than M. So you get a black hole only if the angular momentum is bounded by M squared. And what happens beyond that is that the black hole goes too fast, rotates too fast, and it basically becomes a naked singularity. So in order to have a spacetime that has a regular event horizon and a singularity that's buried inside the horizon, like we had for Schwarzschild, we have to impose this bound on angular momentum. If we choose to violate the bound by putting way too much spin on our black hole, then, it's not quite accurate to say it like this, but if we try to spin up a black hole, it would destroy itself. But in fact, that's the wrong way of saying it, because if you try to spin up a black hole, you would find that it gets increasingly hard to spin it up faster. And as you approach the extreme limit, where the bound is saturated, you would find that it's impossible to take it beyond that. So anyway, I don't want to make a big deal out of it, just to say that it's going to be important for us in all the calculations we're going to do that this is that this bound is respected. All right. So those are the main things associated with the Kerr metric. So the Kerr solution, another important aspect that I should mention before I write down the metric, is that the Kerr metric is a solution, an exact solution, of course, to the Einstein field equations in vacuum. And there's a very important uniqueness theorem that's very similar to the Israel theorem that we encountered for the Schwarzschild metric. The Kerr metric is a unique solution that describes a black hole in vacuum in a spacetime that's asymptotically flat with a regular event horizon. So I'm going to try to paraphrase this. I might not get the exact terms, but we have a uniqueness theorem that was first sort of initiated by Carter and or a bunch of other people who needed to complete the proof to get rid of all the little loopholes that were left behind. The uniqueness theorem is that that says that the Kerr metric is the unique solution to the vacuum field equations for an asymptotically flat spacetime and I should say for a stationary asymptotically flat spacetime with a non-singular event horizon. So here, the symmetries that come out of the Kerr metric, namely the fact that, the stationary assumption is assumed, but the Kerr metric, as we're going to see in a moment, comes also with a symmetry of rotation around the axis. So it's an axisymmetric spacetime. That is not put in as an assumption. That's a consequence of the uniqueness theorem. So just in the same way that spherical symmetry was not an assumption in the Schwarzschild solution when we're describing static black holes, here the axis symmetry that we're going to recognize in a moment is also a consequence of the uniqueness theorem. So the Kerr metric is very special. It's a very, specialized solution to the Einstein-Field equations, but it's the only one that can describe a black hole under all of those conditions: asymptotic flatness, vacuum, and stationary. And it's remarkably simple. I mean, it's more complicated than Schwarzschild, but it's remarkably simple. We can write it down in just a few lines and, you know, play with it, which is going to be what we're going to be doing. Okay, so that's that. Before I go further, I would like to point out a very common misconception about the Kerr metric. And I think it's important to quash that once and for all. So for Schwarzschild, we had Birkhoff's theorem that said that you can have a spherically symmetric body that is either static or time dependent, doesn't matter, could be pulsating, could be collapsing, doesn't matter. And the spacetime outside will be given by the Schwarzschild metric, regardless of the details of the inside. So the question is, and the answer will be no, can we make a statement like this about the Kerr solution? Is there a Birkhoff's theorem for the Kerr solution? Can we imagine that we have a rotating body and that outside, because it's a vacuum solution, we would have a Kerr metric for that rotating body? In other words, we would do for Schwarzschild like we would normally do for a star. We would say that the inside is something, you know, corresponding to the matter inside. But because it's spherically symmetric, the vacuum outside must be Schwarzschild. Here, can we have, you know, a rotating body of a, you know, of any sort, described by its own metric, you know, with a non-zero stress tensor, giving rise to an outside metric that's the Kerr solution? So the conception, the misconception is that people often think that the answer is yes to that. And the answer is no. The answer is no. The outside metric of a rotating body is not going to be the Kerr solution. It cannot be the Kerr solution. You'll only get the Kerr solution if there's no body and there's a black hole. So the answer is no. So the Kerr metric is not the exterior metric of a rotating body, unless the body is a black hole. The reason for this is simply that if you're dealing with a rotating body, you can provide a lot of details as to how the rotation will be distributed inside the body, how the mass is distributed inside the body. And all of those details will feed a very specific multiple structure for the body. So you're going to have the mass, the angular momentum, those are the primitive multiple moments. But you're going to have, you know, a quadrupole moment for the mass distribution, an octuple moment. You're going to have all of those moments. And you're going to have multiple moments corresponding to the distribution of matter currents. So there are two sets of moments, the mass moments and the current moments, that are, you know, associated with the way that the matter moves. And a rotating body like this, depending on the details of the outside, will come with, you know, its own set of multiple moments. So you're going to have, you know, monopole moment for mass, and then you're going to have, so let's list those first. You're going to have the monopole moment for mass, you're going to have a quadrupole moment, you're going to have an octupole moment, and you're going to have a whole bunch of additional moments like this. And then we're going to have moments associated with the motion of the matter. That's going to give rise to a dipole moment that we call angular momentum, and then there's going to be higher versions of that. And all of those moments will be determined by the precise distribution of matter that you have inside that body. A Kerr black hole comes with its own set of multiple moments. Of course, we would match m and, you know, the angular momentum if we wanted to match a Kerr metric to the outside metric of that rotating body. So we can, you know, ensure that m and j are the same. But after that, it would be game over. The mass quadrupole moment for Kerr, the mass octuple moment for Kerr and all of the other ones, and similar for all of the current moments, they would be all, you know, distinctive of the Kerr black hole, and they would have nothing to do with those. You could not match the higher multiple moments, even if you can match the mass and the angular momentum. So for this very basic reason that has to do with the fact that there's a lot more freedom in describing a body outside of spherical symmetry, you know, a body outside of spherical symmetry comes with all of those multiple moments to describe it, and there's no way of matching the moments you would get for the matter to the moments that you do get for the Kerr black hole. Those are very specific, and they would never match whatever you get for the matter. So for that reason, the Kerr metric is not the exterior metric of a rotating body. If you want to describe the exterior metric of a rotating body, you have to construct a vacuum solution to the field equations with that multiple structure, which is very distinct from that multiple structure. So I think that, you know, is worth spending the time to make sure that it's understood, because I've seen that mistake being made all over the place by people who are not really experts in GR, who don't know these things, and they think that you can just, you know, take the Kerr metric to be a candidate for the metric outside a rotating body, and that's just not true. It's too specific for that. It applies to a black hole. It doesn't apply to anything else. Yeah, question?
So does this imply that you can't have like a Kerr mimicker?
So that's a very good point, and that brings me to an editorial comment I tend to make sometimes. The Kerr metric is special because it describes a black hole and because it contains an event horizon that's regular. If you want to play the game of black hole mimickers and say that your spacetime is a spacetime of something that's not a black hole but close to a black hole, there's really no reason to think that that spacetime should be close to the Kerr spacetime, because the Kerr spacetime is special because of the event horizon. If you take out the event horizon, there's no reason why all of those moments should be close to what is given to you by the Kerr metric. No reason at all. But that's the game that people play. They just pretend that the metric is just, you know, a small, you know, perturbation away from the Kerr metric, and, you know, they pretend that this is something that could be found in nature. I think there's no reason to expect that. Good. Other questions about this? Okay, so I hope that this point was clear. Okay, so let's write down the Kerr metric, and then we'll look into the properties of the Kerr spacetime and learn to, you know, get acquainted with, you know, all that it gives us, because it gives us quite a lot. Okay, so let's write down the Kerr metric. And we're going to use a system of coordinates that was not the one that Kerr initially worked in. They're called Bore-Lindquist coordinates. And those coordinates are, you know, fairly analogous to the Schwarzschild coordinates that we get for the Schwarzschild metric, with the same problem associated with the time coordinate. And in fact, it's worse because it's not just the time coordinate that goes bad on the horizon, it's also the phi coordinate. So that's something we're gonna have to, you know, account for, take into account, and fix later. So let me introduce some notation that's frustratingly not standard. I mean, a lot of people come up with different names for those things, and it's hard to sometimes, you know, reconcile all of the notation. But, you know, I'll use whatever I happen to choose from somewhere in the literature. So rho is just defined to be that specific function of r and theta. Delta, that's pretty standard. That's r squared minus 2mr plus a squared. And sigma, not that standard, is r squared plus a squared all squared minus a squared delta sine squared. So that's just notation that helps us to write the metric in short lines. Okay, I'll write it in terms of metric components. I could write it in terms of a line element, but I think it's just as easy to write it like this. The GTT is minus 1 plus 2mr divided by rho squared. GT phi, it used to be 0 in Schwarzschild, now it's not 0, and it has directly to do with rotation. That's minus 2am. So you see the angular momentum coming in right here. R sine squared theta divided by rho squared. GRR is equal to rho squared divided by delta. G theta theta is rho squared. And G phi phi is sigma sine squared theta divided by rho squared. So really not that bad, especially if you introduce those helpful functions. And for example, if you look at, well, how does it differ from Schwarzschild? Well, of course, it differs in the detail, and especially in the presence of that T phi component. So that's how we know we have rotation. We have that component in the metric. But for example, if we look at the behavior at large distances, so at large distances, rho behaves like r. So we get minus 1 plus 2m over r. That's basically the Schwarzschild behavior plus higher order corrections. Over here, we get r squared divided by delta, which is also basically r squared at large distances. So at large distances, grr goes to 1, like Schwarzschild does. G theta theta becomes r squared. G phi phi becomes, well, this big mess here becomes r to the fourth divided by r squared, so that's r squared sine theta squared. So it's basically the same sort of asymptotic behavior that we got for Schwarzschild, but with one essential change in that T phi component. Sometimes we're gonna need the inverse metric, so I might as well give it to you right here. So the inverse metric is minus sigma divided by rho squared divided by lambda, delta, sorry. GT phi is minus 2am r divided by rho squared and delta. GRR is delta over rho squared. G theta theta is 1 over rho squared. And G phi phi is, this one is a bit complicated, it's delta minus a squared sine squared theta divided by rho squared delta sine squared theta. All right, so a bit more complicated than Schwarzschild, but given that we're talking about the metric of all black holes out there in the universe that happen to be stationary and in vacuum, it's pretty remarkable that, you know, we can get away with something like that. The claim, of course, is that if you put that metric in a calculator and calculate the Ricci tensor, you're going to find that all components are zero, So we are talking about a vacuum solution to the Einstein-Fields equations. Now, two essential properties. We have two killing vectors. One is the one that I talked about before. It's the timeline killing vector. And that corresponds to the fact that, wherever you look in the metric, you'll never see a T. So the metric is time independent. Therefore, there's a timeline killing vector associated with that. And we have also an axial killing vector, something that points in the direction of phi, that corresponds to the fact that there's no phi dependence anywhere in the metric. In Schwarzschild, we had those two plus two additional ones that give us the full spherical symmetry of the spacetime. Here, we only have those two that correspond to the stationary aspect and the axisymmetry aspect of the spacetime. So this is stationary, and this is axisymmetric. For those who know, I don't think we'll need that in the lectures, there's actually another killing type structure present in the spacetime that's sort of hidden. It doesn't, jump up at us like this when we stare at the metric. And that's something called a killing tensor that has properties similar to what a killing vector would have. And that's something that plays an important role when it's time to write down the geodesic equations and present the solutions in integrated form. That's something that is absolutely essential to the description of motion around Kerr, another miracle of the Kerr metric, but I'm not going to be, I'm not going to use that. And so I'll just mention it like this, just in passing. Okay, so that's the full metric. And what we'd like to do now is to, just spend a little bit of time and explore the physics of the Kerr metric and see what properties this black hole has that the Schwarzschild black hole doesn't have. And the differences, of course, will all be attributed to rotation. So the rotational aspects of the black hole means that, well, there's more to this black hole than for Schwarzschild. And I think we need to spend some time getting acquainted with all of this. So to get acquainted with the spacetime, what I'm going to do is to do what we tend to do when we're given a spacetime and we want to understand its properties. We're going to think of inserting observers in that spacetime, and we're going to ask them, what do you see? And we're going to have a whole, some different classes of observers that we're going to look at, and we're going to ask them, so what do you see, and what do you, what can you tell us about the spacetime? And, the big underlying question is, how do we go about locating the event horizon? How do we identify the essential aspects of the spacetime that are provided to us because now we have rotation? And the goal of introducing those observers is going to be to unravel all of that. So let's talk about, I'm going to introduce three classes of observers. Probably I won't have time to do all of that in the next 30 minutes, but we'll get started. So the first class of observers, I'm going to call zero angular momentum observers, or ZAMOs for short, and that stands for zero angular momentum observers. So what do I mean by that, and why are they interesting? Well, we're going to see that you can let yourself fall toward a rotating black hole and give yourself no rotation to begin with, and the black hole itself will start rotating you around. So that's something that we can see right away with this class of observers. So what do I mean by zero angular momentum observers? I'm just saying, I'm just recalling the fact that if we have a killing vector and we have a geodesic motion, then the component of the four velocity in the direction of the killing vector is a constant of the motion. So that tells us that u phi is a constant of the motion. So, well, pretty clear. And what I'm going to do is to set that equal to zero. So I'm going to look at those observers that freely fall inside the Kerr black hole, but they do so without having any amount of angular momentum as we define it. And the surprise is that even though they don't have any angular momentum, they will be rotating around the black hole. So very unintuitive notion that is, you know, given to us by the rotation of the spacetime. It's not unique to Kerr, but that's something that would happen for any spacetime that contains rotation, that is produced by a rotating body. All right, so what's the consequence of this? Well, what I'm going to do is to re-express the zero component of u phi with the index down, with the components of the velocity vector with the index up. So I'm just going to lower the index on u alpha to get u phi, and I'm just going to work this out. So if I look at the sum over alpha, well, the first possibility here is that I'm going to have a t standing in for alpha because I have a non-zero t phi component of the metric. And then the other possibility is to have a phi phi component in the metric. So there are only two terms in the sum over alpha, one involving t, the other one involving phi. All the other components of the metric vanish. So there's no r phi component of the metric. There's no theta phi component. OK, so what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that there's a relationship between the time and phi component that gives us a zero left-hand side. So if I solve for u phi divided by ut, I'm going to get that this is equal to minus gt phi divided by g phi phi. Well, that's just simple algebra. But what's the meaning of this? The meaning of this is that, well, u phi is just phi dot, if the dot means differentiation with respect to proper time. Ut is t dot, where the dot is, again, differentiation with respect to proper time. So what I'm writing out here is simply d phi dt, something that we would interpret as angular velocity measured in terms of phi and measured in terms of coordinate time t. So, conclusion, we have that our zero angular momentum observer will fall in, and as it falls in, it will have a non-zero angular velocity measured by d phi d tau. And in fact, it's going to have a very specific value for angular velocity given by that component of the metric, this ratio over here. It's going to be minus gt phi over g phi phi. Gt phi is negative, so that's going to be a positive quantity. And that positive quantity I'll just call omega. So omega is just going to be shorthand for that ratio over here. And then if I work this out, omega is going to be, well, gt phi, which is 2am r sine squared theta divided by rho squared. And then that's divided by g phi phi, which is sigma sine squared divided by rho squared. So that simplifies. We lose the rho squared. We lose the sine theta squared. And the bottom line here is that our ZAMOs do have a non-zero angular velocity that's given to us by this ratio. And I write it as 2 a.m. r divided by sigma. So what's the behavior of this? If we look at this at large r, sigma can be approximated by r to the fourth. So asymptotically, this is 2 times j divided by r cubed. So of course, the effect is very small at large distances. But as the observer keeps falling in, the effect picks up. And what we find is that even though the observer fell in without angular momentum, that doesn't mean that it will continue to go without angular velocity. The the observer automatically acquires an angular velocity that behaves like this. So that effect is something that is not specific, as I said, to the Kerr black hole, but it's something that really has to do with a rotating spacetime. A rotating spacetime will, you know, communicate some of its rotation to observers that fall in, whether or not they have rotation to begin with. Here they don't because of the zero angular momentum, so they fall in radially, but you know, gradually and unavoidably, those observers falling in radially start moving forward in the phi direction, dragged along by the rotating body here at the black hole. So that effect is called sometimes the Lenz-Thiering effect, after the people who first discovered it, I think going back to 1918 or something like that. But it's also called the dragging of inertial frames . And that's a phrase that's a bit, you know, that's a lot more informative because it does give the notion that the black hole or the rotating body, more generally speaking, is dragging along observers in the direction of rotation. So there's a very specific sense of rotation here that's specified by the direction of rotation of the black hole itself. So observers falling in, if we have a rotating black hole, they fall in radially from a large distance, but gradually they start being dragged along like this. And eventually they might fall in like this, but they will be falling in with a non-zero angular velocity. So a rather remarkable property of curved space-time when you start including rotational effects, which we don't always do, but of course for a curved black hole, we have to. So we're good with that. So what emerges here at this stage is that, you know, given this choice of observers, you know, the ones that have the least amount of angular velocity that we can imagine, zero angular momentum, those observers will be forced by the black hole to rotate along with the black hole. So that's something that we'll grab on because that turns out to be something that can be fought, to some extent, but eventually if you get too close to the black hole, that dragging effect is going to be so strong that you can't help yourself. You will have to move along with the black hole and rotate along with it. It's not a choice, it's a matter of obligation. So the dragging of inertial frames becomes completely overwhelming beyond a certain point. So that's what we're going to be looking into. All right, so those were observers number one. Let's look at a different class of observers. And I'm going to sort of fight this over here, and I'm going to install observers in the spacetime that are static. I'm going to declare them to be static. They're not going to be geodesic, because to make them be static at a given location in the Kerr spacetime, we're going to have to provide rockets. We're going to have to make them, fight the attraction of gravity. But we're going to see, what those observers can do in order to fight this dragging effect that we've just talked about. So observers number two are going to be static observers. And that just means what it means. It means that the observers are sitting in one place and never moving from that place. So they're going to have a four velocity that's going to be entirely pointing along the time direction. They don't move in space. they only move in time. And the way I'm going to express this is there's going to be a gamma factor here that's going to be a normalization factor for the velocity. And it's going to be a vector that points entirely in the time direction. So I can write it like this in components, or I can just say that this is a vector that's aligned with the time-like killing vector. So we're going to look at observers like this, and we're going to ask, well, can we put observers like that everywhere in the space-time? So is it possible for anyone to sit still in the gravitational field of a Kerr black hole? And the answer is going to be it's possible if we're far enough away. Plain impossible if we're too close. And there's a limit where it no longer becomes, you know, where it's no longer possible to do that. That limit is called the static limit, naturally enough. So let's look into that. And the basic requirement here is going to be that this has to be a time-like vector, right? So if it's to describe an observer, it has to be a time-like vector. So we want, we want this to be, well, I want to normalize it. So it's got to be equal to minus one. So it's got to be a negative. So the norm of the time-like killing vector has to be negative. Okay. So the point is that what's going to happen, what we're going to see when we do the math, is that we can maintain the vector as a time-like vector up to a certain point, and beyond that point is just impossible. And the criterion will be that, you know, in order for that to be true, we're going to insist that gamma should be finite. If we run into a situation where, in order to enforce this, gamma runs into an infinity, then we're going to conclude that, well, that vector cannot exist and that the static condition cannot be maintained. So we're going to see where this leads us as we work this out. Okay, so we have that minus one must be equal to the norm of our time-like vector. And when we work this out, well, this is gamma squared times the GTT component of the metric. So what we would do here, knowing what GTT is, would be to solve for gamma squared, and gamma squared would be minus 1 over GTT. And the idea is that, well, you know, we have a solution until, we have a solution until gamma is forced to go to infinity. So what we want to ensure is that gamma squared remains smaller than infinity. And, you know, if it goes to infinity, that will be an indication that this vector is actually trying to be null instead of, you know, being time-like. And that's the condition. And the condition, of course, translates into a condition that GTT, minus GTT, which is positive, that has to be larger than zero. So if GTT goes to zero for any reason, for example, because we're too close to the black hole, then if GTT goes to zero, gamma goes to infinity, and that vector ceases to exist, and that means that we cannot support static observers beyond that point, right? So that's the idea. So it's a very simple idea, but, you know, I think sometimes, you know, when it's too simple, you can, you know, there's a danger of not getting it, but that's the idea. So we want that vector to exist for static observers to exist. That means that gamma has to be smaller than infinity, and that means that minus GTT has to be greater than zero. So we know what minus GTT is. What we need is 1 minus 2m r divided by rho squared to be positive. So I'll multiply through by rho squared, so that is always positive, so we don't have to worry about rho squared changing sign. And if I put that in, we have that r squared minus 2mr plus a squared cosine squared theta. The condition for the static observer to exist is that this inequality be maintained for our, you know, in the space-time. So we're going to have an existing time-like vector like this provided that this inequality is satisfied. And it's pretty clear that this means that we have to be outside of a certain radius for that to be true. And how do we figure this out? Well, we just solve for the quadratic equation, and that will tell us that r has to be larger than the largest root of that equation. Right? So in order for that to be true, r has to be larger than the largest root of that equation. We solve for the quadratic, and we get that r has to be larger than, how do I call it? I call it r static. And r static is going to be the solution to that quadratic equation. And I don't think I need to do the math here. It's going to be m plus, because it has to be the largest root, m squared minus a squared cosine squared theta. So the conclusion here is that we can maintain static observers only for values of r that are larger than this limiting value over here. And the statement is that, you know, those static observers can live outside of that region. If we try to put them inside, it doesn't work. That vector can no longer be time-like. And at the boundary, at r equals static, we have that this goes to infinity, which means that the vector is actually no longer time-like, but becoming null at that very specific place. So let's draw a picture to describe this. I'm going to draw a polar diagram. And it's going to look like this. So it's not a very good rendition. But the idea is that, that's my origin over here. The angle with respect to the z-axis here is the theta angle. And what I'm plotting here in a polar, that's pretty horrible. It's supposed to be reflection symmetric. Yeah, that's going to be better. So that's the theta angle, and that's r static as a function of theta. And the interpretation is that when theta is equal to 0, r static takes this value over here, and then theta increases, r theta increases, and then it reaches an upper limit over here when theta is equal to pi over 2. And then we return back to theta equals pi, and we're right here. So when theta is equal to 0 or pi, this radius here is m plus m squared minus a squared. And when we're over here, that's the situation where theta is equal to pi over 2. The cosine of the angle is 0. And we get m plus square root of m squared. So this is r equals 2m right here. So that's the polar diagram of this. And the idea is that outside of this limiting radius here, we can have static observers. But in here, we cannot. So the interpretation of this, of course, is that, well, you know, all the while those observers are fighting against the rotation of the black hole. That's the natural tendency to be, you know, pushed forward by the dragging of inertial frames. And but if the observer decides that, you know, they're going to fight this and stay put at a given spatial location, then they're fighting against this, and the ability to fight is completely lost if they get too close to the black hole. And beyond the static limit over here, they've lost the fight completely. It's no longer possible to fight this rotation. And the idea is that, well, it might be possible to get closer to the center. I'm not going to say black hole just yet. It might be possible to get closer to the center than the static limit. But for that, you cannot hope to stay static. You might be able to get closer if you allow yourself to rotate along with the black hole. And that's going to be the next class of observers we'll look at. But I think I ran out of time, so we'll leave that for next week. So that's the game that we're playing here. We're introducing observers to flesh out, basically, to understand the properties of the space-time through observations that those observers would make. over there, we observe that the black hole rotation is dragging along the observers, and they acquire angular velocity because of that. Here we see that observers that are trying to stay static can succeed only outside of the static limit, completely fail inside, and that tells us that at that point, the black hole rotation is overwhelming, and static observers can't fight it no longer. And the only way that we can go inside of that limit is to let the black hole win, and then let ourselves rotate along with it. And that's going to be the next class of observers that are not going to be static, but rotating along with the black hole, not necessarily, well, we'll get there next time. And then we're going to see that we're going to be able to get a little bit closer in, but there's going to be a limit to that too, and that limit will happen to be the event horizon. That's not the event horizon. That's a structure that lives outside of the event horizon, except at those points here. Inside of that, there will be the event horizon. And of course, you cannot maintain a stationary state outside the black hole if you're inside the event horizon. So there's going to be a final limit that we're going to describe that describes the event horizon. And that basically will tell us pretty much everything we, not everything, but, a good part of what we need to know about the Kerr spacetime. So that we'll get to next time. So any questions before we quit for the day? Yep.
How can we be sure that it's the rotational aspect that's forcing this non-static behavior? Like, in general, could it be another effect in the spacetime?
Yeah, so there might be different spacetimes where instead of having rotation, we have something else. And there are various exotic things that can be introduced in spacetimes, like nut charges or topological defects and things like that. And there would be effects associated with those, but they wouldn't be exactly the same effect. So I think, in practice, it's not that difficult to disentangle what is a rotational effect. Rotation tends to induce rotation, so it's sort of easy to make an association. But there would be other effects that would be perhaps easy to disentangle, maybe more difficult to disentangle, that would have different causes. So to a large extent, we're just putting words into what's going on. And they, I think, sound plausible. But, there could always be all sorts of other things going on that we're not, describing very clearly. But I think for the Kerr spacetime, I think, that's basically the only new thing that we're adding to the space-time, so it's plausible that, it really has to do with that. Other questions? Yep?
So, I'm assuming we're talking about the topological stuff, or the multiple structure of Kerr. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, then when you study this terminology of black holes, you can't base that Kerr or the perturbation of Kerr, because the accretion is without structure.
Yeah. So everything I said about Kerr has to do with the idea that the Kerr black hole lives in vacuum. If there's matter around the black hole, and in the real universe, there's certainly matter around the black hole, then that matter changes the nature of space-time, and that metric will no longer be a Kerr metric. But we can account for those effects sometimes in perturbation theory, sometimes by just solving the Einstein field equations, completely again with different boundary conditions, with different matter distributions. But yeah, if we want to, the Kerr solution is really applicable to a vacuum situation. Yeah. Okay, sounds good. So let's pick this up again next time.